Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I have numerous sassafras trees on my property, and I just sell it to people. They make tea out of it, and some people try to make root beer out of it.
One of John Allen Flynn's customers is a local chef who has perfected a root beer recipe. She'll walk us through it. American consumers enjoy a vast supply of affordable beef, pork, and poultry, but the workers who help that meat reach our tables sometimes pay a price. We'll hear part one of a series by Harvest Public Media called Dangerous Jobs, Cheap Meat. Then, while the oven is on for roasting tomatillos, we roast some other seasonal veggies to serve with eggs for breakfast. And some farmers have opened up their land to hunters who are looking to bag some snow geese. News at the top of the show with Mark Chilla.
The Philadelphia City Council voted 13-4 in favor of a 1.5 cent per ounce soda tax, a feat that has eluded 40 other U.S. cities. The American Beverage Association, which represents PepsiCo and Coca-Cola, says it plans to take legal action to stop the Philly tax, but Mayor Jim Kenney says the city will defend the tax in any litigation from the beverage industry. While the passage of the tax marks a victory for public health advocates, Mayor Kenney focused his efforts more on the financial benefit of the tax. It's expected to bring in $91 million in revenue in the next year to fund universal pre-K and other infrastructure initiatives in the city. The passage of the tax in Philadelphia is expected to boost similar efforts in San Francisco, Oakland, and Boulder, Colorado, where residents will vote on soda tax measures in November. The only other city in the U.S. to make it this far in taxing sugary drinks is Berkeley, California, which passed a measure in 2014. In a landslide 3-1 margin vote, 75% of North Dakotans voted this week to repeal Senate Bill 2351. The bill, which was set to take effect last August, was signed into law in March of last year by Republican Governor Jack Dalrymple. It allowed corporations to own and operate dairy and hog farms on 640 acres of land or fewer, in a state that previously prohibited all corporate dairy and swine operations since 1932. North Dakota is one of 9 U.S. states that have laws limiting corporate farming. The law says to operate in the state, companies must have no more than 15 shareholders, and all must be first cousins or closer in relations. A report from Chile's government says the amount of antibiotics used per ton of salmon has reached the highest level since 2007. The country's salmon production has dropped as it battles outbreaks of a deadly fish disease known as SRS. Farmers are using more antibiotics to combat the disease. But demand for antibiotic-free fish among American consumers has spiked amid fears of antibiotic-resistant superbugs. Last year, Costco stopped buying salmon from Chile and switched to Norway, where farmers use fewer antibiotics. Chile's report comes a little more than a week after an environmental group won a lawsuit demanding more transparency about antibiotics use in salmon. This year, Chile's salmon farming industry has also been hit with red-tide algae blooms, which killed off 15% of the country's fish stocks and caused $800 million in losses. And in 1991, the World Health Organization International Agency for Research on Cancer listed coffee as a possible carcinogen. This classification was based on what the IARC says was limited evidence that coffee was associated with a higher risk of bladder cancer. But over the past 25 years, the body of evidence has pointed in a new direction. And this week, the WHO's research agency concluded that coffee does not pose a cancer risk. In fact, a regular coffee habit may even protect your health. Researchers reviewed more than 500 studies on more than 20 different types of cancers. The group concludes that coffee may in fact help protect against the risk of cancers of the liver and uterus. In addition, coffee consumption has been associated with a reduced risk of colorectal cancer in a number of studies. There's even more to read at eartheats.org. Reporters from all over the country are posting stories on our website throughout the week.
Stay close to our Twitter feed for food and farming stories all day, every day. We're at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla, always appreciate your work.
No problem.
You've probably seen big flocks of snow geese fly over your house every spring. The booming population of those fluffy, noisy, white birds is creating an environmental disaster up in Canada, and it's partially thanks to decisions made by Midwest farmers. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted explains.
It's snack time for thousands of snow geese at these Arkansas fields of rice and wheat. Researcher Drew Fowler recorded this video last year while collecting geese for a study.
The birds have grown exponentially and almost now to a concern that they're causing a destruction to their tundra breeding grounds.
Snow geese are migratory. They spend spring and summer in chilly Canada to breed and overwinter in the Gulf Coast marshlands, munching on wetland plants. The grueling trip to Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas can be more than 5,000 miles in total.
But now that agriculture exists in the form of rice, in the form of winter wheat and corn, really, as you move anywhere further north of Arkansas, it's allowed these birds to, instead of taking a long leap type migration, to make a stepping stone type migration.
Over the last few decades, Midwest farmers have plowed up prairies to plant corn and wheat. Now, the Midwest flyway back to Canada is like one long buffet line with grain left over from harvest. That's resulted in an explosion in the snow geese population. In the 1960s, there was an estimated 800,000 geese. Today, the estimates put the number upwards of 13 million. Mark Vertiska is the waterfowl program manager with Nebraska Game and Parks Commission. The geese buffet line extends into Nebraska, and he says the birds have shifted their migration pattern to the state's rainwater basin area to take advantage.
Historically, the rainwater basin region, for example, in the 70s and early 80s and so forth, you didn't see a whole lot of snow geese in that region. 20 years later, in like 2001, we estimated 7 million snow geese in the rainwater basin region that one year.
But here is the problem. The birds are showing up in droves to the Arctic and subarctic breeding grounds along Canada's Hudson Bay. They're devouring plant resources. Jim Leaflore is a waterfowl biologist for the Canadian Wildlife Service.
In areas where we've seen a lot of damage along the coast, for example, James Bay, Hudson Bay, it's pretty obvious that there's less food available to birds that are there than what used to be there.
Leaflore says in some instances, the voracious snow geese are mowing down all vegetation, which means no food for shorebirds like the sandpiper.
If shorebirds, for example, are occupying some of these same habitats, and the snow geese are wiping out or negatively affecting some of these habitats, then there's a potential that shorebirds or other species will decline in response to this large population of geese.
And that could throw off the whole ecosystem. To manage the overpopulation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service majorly relaxed hunting regulations on geese in 1999. Some farmers have even opened up their property to outfitters looking for prime hunting grounds. Researchers say that's helped slow the rate of goose population growth, but numbers still remain high. Drew Fowler with the University of Missouri has been trying to figure out why. Every year he collects geese for research. Today, he's outside shaving the feathers off the bird bodies at the South Farm Research Center in Columbia, Missouri. White feathers float through the air like it's a cinematic pillow fight.
It's like a little miniature beauty salon.
Fowler thinks that hunting may actually not be that effective. Hunters, he says, might only catch weaker birds, less likely to breed.
It's not just the few number of birds that we're shooting that's making the conservation order not effective in reducing population size, but it's also that we're probably shooting the wrong type of bird.
At the end of the week, Fowler will have processed nearly 500 birds. He says he hopes conservation groups and wildlife agencies can use the information to figure out an even better way to manage growing numbers of snow geese before more damage is done. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
John Allen Flynn's table at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market is divided in two parts.
Basically, this side of the table is foraging. Yeah, this is gardening, and this is my wood stuff, right.
The result is a really diverse offering this morning. Blackberries, broccoli, zucchini, peppers, walnuts, and sassafras.
I have numerous sassafras trees on my property, and I just sell it to people. They make tea out of it, and some people try to make root beer out of it.
Jackie Howard came across Flynn's table one Saturday morning. She shops at the farmer's market all the time for local fruit to incorporate into her soda recipes. She's a co-owner of Bee's Soda Bar. Sassafras bark is usually hard to find, she says, so she knew she found something special with Flynn. She immediately started playing with root beer recipes to see what could work for her food truck.
You could take it and ferment it, which is what a lot of root beer is made, similar to actually making beer. What we do is make a syrup and then combine that with club soda.
That way, it's easier for them to transport because they wouldn't have to bottle or keg it. And they could also use the syrup in other preparations. Root beer shot in your coffee? Why not? She started with your basic root beer recipe of wintergreen, sarsaparilla, sassafras, and anise. That was the base. Then it was time to experiment. One batch had hops. That got mixed reviews. Lavender and coffee grounds made appearances. After lots of tinkering, the final list includes the basics plus burdock root, wild cherry bark, cinnamon sticks, and vanilla beans.
And then we always do throw just a splash of lemon juice into it, just to add some acidity, again, to kind of like give that little pop that you want from a soda. You really, when you think about it, you're essentially making a sweet tea. You know, like that's what making this syrup comes out to, because it's all these different roots and leaves, and you know, like, that's what it is. So you're making a tea.
And as with many teas, this recipe is pretty light, both in flavor and color. Jackie wanted her root beer to be bold.
So to add that depth without adding caramel color and things like that that you get in a bottled root beer, that's where we add the molasses. We use brown sugar to add some depth.
Along with turbinado and cane sugar, she lets the mixture steep just like a tea, and then reduces it down by a third, and we're ready to try it.
So then you're gonna put it into the glass. You wanna pour it over ice. Soda needs to be really cold for it to be as fizzy as possible.
The anise smell in that is overwhelming.
Right, it definitely, it is very anisey, and it's interesting. It's very little anise in comparison to everything else that you're putting into it. This, I think after you taste it, it won't seem as anisey to you. We like the club soda for that carbonic bite. Give it a good stir, folding that syrup up into your soda so you don't lose the fizz from the soda.
Okay, I'm going to give it a taste.
All right.
Ooh, I like that a lot. I'm trying to figure out what that... There's something unique in there that I don't get from typical bottled root beer. What is that?
Probably the sassafras, honestly. When you get any sort of bottled root beer that you would buy at the store, it does not have sassafras.
I'm just going to keep drinking this. It's so delicious. Make Bee's Soda Bar's signature root beer recipe for yourself. I know I want to try it. The recipe is at eartheats.org. So, what does John Allen Flynn think about the root beer made from his sassafras?
I don't know. He has not tasted our root beer. He knows that we make root beer, but he's just happy to bring us bundles and bundles. All right, I'll bring you more next week. I'll bring you more next week. So he's really great.
Coming up in the kitchen, Daniel Orr picked out some peppers and eggplant and a young zucchini.
Anything that you could kind of scoop out and fill, like if you're doing stuffed vegetables, you could use for this dish.
What'll be inside? Eggs. But before that, a trip into the garden results in some salsa. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
It's Earth Eats. Welcome back. I'm Annie Corrigan. Like every other gardener these days, Daniel Orr is working hard to keep weeds out of his beds, and he's harvesting what he can while he prunes plants to keep the growth coming. Then there are some crops that do all the work for him, like tomatillos.
And the wonderful thing about this, if you've listened to some of the old shows, we've talked about volunteers in the garden. Tomatillos are wonderful volunteers. Every year, you get so many of them. A few of them drop. They come back the next year, and it's just kind of a perpetual tomatillo bed. So we haven't planted tomatillos in probably 10 or 15 years. They just always come back, and we're always overwhelmed. So the greatest thing to do is to make a salsa verde, and that's a roasted tomatillo salsa. And so that's what we're going to go do. So let's go pick some tomatillos. So here they are, and they look kind of like Japanese lanterns here. So they have this kind of papery husk on the outside, and you just kind of tear that off, and there you go, it's the tomatillo. Here's another big one down here. And there's one up there. They're kind of, it's kind of fun, because every day you'll find ones that you missed the day before. So let's go in the kitchen and get these roasted up. So I'm just going to give these guys a nice wash. Tomatillos sometimes have kind of a sticky residue on the outside of them, so just want to give that a rinse. I'm going to chop up some onions. Okay, what we're going to do is toss these in a bowl. Okay, I'm going to add my chili pepper. We're going to put a little lemon zest in this one. We're going to put in about 4 or 5 cloves of garlic. And I'm going to toss that with just a couple tablespoons of olive oil. And we're going to put these in an oven-proof pan. Okay, and then we're going to put these under the broiler. What we want to do is to really caramelize them a little bit. Get a little bit of color on them, and that's also going to evaporate some of the moisture in the onions and the tomatillos, which will make the sauce a little bit thicker and give it great flavor.
So we'll wait on this for about 45 minutes or so. Keep an eye on it. Pull it out when you're happy with the amount of caramelization. Hundreds of thousands of people go to work each day preparing the beef, pork, and poultry that ends up on our dinner plates. Their workplace is among the most hazardous in the country. Slaughterhouses, while safer than they were decades ago, exact a steep price from workers, sometimes even their lives. In the first part of our series, Dangerous Jobs, Cheap Meat, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon takes a look at one tragic case in Colorado.
On the worst day of Greta Horner's life, she was dressed in a burlap robe, waiting by the window for her husband to come home from work, so she could head to teach Vacation Bible School at their church.
And I was dressed up in a costume like Old Jerusalem.
Ralph, or Ed as his family calls him, should have been pulling in the driveway any minute, home from his overnight shift as a maintenance guy at the beef plant in Greeley, Colorado. It's owned by JBS, the world's largest meat packer. Instead, 3 cars, one from the coroner's office, pulled in.
And they seemed to be going so slowly. And I thought, this isn't good.
Greta went down to the gate.
They introduced themselves, and I just said, don't tell me. I don't even want to know. Don't tell me, because I just knew.
Ed died a few hours earlier. He was working deep in the bowels of the plant, oiling a conveyor belt.
And his sleeve got caught.
The machine pulled him in, his shirt bunching up around his neck and mouth.
And so he died of asphyxiation.
Ed's story is unfortunately not all that unique. 3 other JBS employees in North America died from injuries sustained on the job that same year, in 2014, all within 5 months of each other. Ed's death triggered a flurry of activity for government regulators. The law required the conveyor belt he was working on to be covered in a metal guard. Inspectors with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration fined the plant for lacking those mechanical guards.
It was something that they had been cited for before and hadn't fixed. And because of that action, or inaction, Ed died.
In a press release after the incident, OSHA scolded the meatpacker, saying the death was preventable. But after a year of negotiation, the total fines for the violations that led to Ed Horner's death totaled $38,500.
Yes, it's embarrassingly low.
Debbie Berkowitz is a fellow with the National Employment Law Project and a former senior OSHA official.
And because of that, it's, you know, unclear exactly what kind of deterrent effect it really has.
An investigation by Harvest Public Media found OSHA's initial fines for safety violations in meat and poultry plants are, on average, just under $20,000 per case. But companies end up paying even less, negotiating down to about $11,000.
Am I on the record? Let me know when I'm on the record and not on the record.
Herb Gibson runs the OSHA office in Denver. The fine JBS paid for the violations that led to Ed Horner's death was higher than most, he says. And even when violations contribute to a worker death, the agency can't charge companies more money because of that.
The fines could be modified for fatal cases, but that's not what the law does not have a separate penalty for a fatality. And that would require legislation to change that particular provision.
We don't need OSHA to come in and find this stuff. We need to find it ourselves.
That's Doug Schult, a JBS Human Resources executive. He says the events of 2014, with four worker deaths, shook the company. Not only was JBS losing workers, but safety blind spots weren't caught, Schult says.
To me, that was the biggest learning that came out of this, is we're still missing some of these things that we should be seeing. How come we're not seeing them?
All it took was one unseen trap for Ed Horner to lose his life. One piece of wire mesh over that spinning conveyor belt could have saved his life. His wife, Greta, says she hopes the company sees just how preventable her husband's death actually was.
They need to realize that everybody that works there is a human being with a life, and it's not just a statistic. It's a person.
Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Parts 2 and 3 of Dangerous Jobs, Cheap Meat will be in next week's program. It's a reporting project looking at the persistent health and safety problems faced by meatpacking workers. HarvestPublicMedia.org is the website. It's about that time for our salsa verde. Daniel pulls out the pan with the tomatillos, onions, and garlic and jalapenos.
Now it's got nice and caramelized. You can kind of see that it's cooked down a little bit. The garlic's got a little bit toasty on top. And we're going to take this and put it in the food processor. I'm going to use some basil. I'm going to add that to it. I'm going to add another toe of raw garlic. And we're going to pulse this. Give it a taste first. That's pretty good.
And there's that. It's delicious and versatile. Follow the recipe at eartheats.org. Then tell us how you enjoy it with chips, spread over fish, or maybe as a topper for our next recipe.
All right.
We know we have lots of breakfast time listeners. Daniel thought about you when he was planning this dish.
We're going to do some baked egg and vegetable cups with tomato and pesto. Today you can see I've got some nice shiny black eggplant. I've got some beautiful red and green peppers, some nice young tender zucchini. Anything that you could kind of scoop out and fill, like if you're doing stuffed vegetables, you could use for this dish. What we're going to do is just cut them into cups. And so I've taken the peppers and cut them in half or into quarters. The eggplant I've cut into discs about, I would say, an inch and a half thick. And then I've scooped them out with a spoon. The same with the zucchini. Then what I've done is I've sprinkled them with some olive oil and some salt and pepper. And then we've roasted those off. So we have some pre-made roasted vegetable cups. All right, what we're going to do now is we're going to crack some nice local eggs. An egg into each one, and they just kind of settle in there. And I'm going to sprinkle them with a little salt and a little pepper. And then I've got some homemade pico de gallo, which means the bite of a rooster. So it's chopped tomatoes, cilantro, onions, garlic. I put a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, and some jalapeno. So it should have that little bite. Okay, and then I'm going to top those with some Parmesan cheese. And we're going to toss those in a hot oven and bake them off until they're nice and brown. Okay, and here we go, right out of the oven. And you can see I also put a little drizzle of tomato juice in the bottom there to help keep them from sticking. Now we're going to plate them. And while these were baking, I put a pot on the stove and I took all those, what I call the guts, the little scraps from the zucchini, peppers, and eggplant, and I diced those up, put them in a pot with some tomato juice and some onion and garlic, and brought that to a boil, and I made a quick little sauce. You see it's kind of chunky. We're just going to ladle that around, and we're just going to garnish it with some green. We've got some fennel tops here, and those are our baked eggs with vegetable cups with a tomato and eggplant sauce.
These look really beautiful, very colorful. The recipe is on our website, along with other first meal ideas from smoothies to breakfast meats to biscuits. Hope to see you at eartheats.org. Our great team of workers at Earth Eats includes Eabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and the wonderful folks at Harvest Public Media. Our executive producer at WFIU is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for making Earth Eats part of your day today.